This is Fuel.
Fuel for thought.
Jet fuel.
Fuel injected.
Fuel for your business.
Welcome back to the Fuel Podcast for New Business, brought to you in association with The Advertist, the UK's only independent new business platform for creative marketing and digital agencies. You can find The Advertist at www.theadvertist.com or call on 0203 356 3717. This is part two of our first family-sized podcast and part two of my interview with Steve Cheliotis of the Centre for Brand Analysis, or TCBA. In episode one, we discussed why some CEOs don't think branding matters, the need for agencies to create their own emotional selling points, employee branding, and how external branding can be undermined by bad internal branding, the rise of the relevancy index, which brands are on the rise, and the growth of homeworking brands. In this episode, we're getting into the meaty subject of how social movements can affect brands, super entrepreneurs, policing your own agility, and looking at brands that Steve predicts will thrive over the next few years. So let's go. Well, if you've just joined us, I'm talking to the chair of the Centre for Brand Analysis, Steve Cheliotis, and we've been covering the importance of brands being able to react to real-world crises such as the global pandemic. But with all brands, Steve, it's important that they walk the talk and the brand promises aren't just written down on press releases, but, I mean, that they're carried through into the real world. And recently, and indeed right now, I mean, there are social movements that require companies, both in the B2C and B2B sectors, to kind of pin their colours to the mast and commit to their employees and customers. And you've obviously noticed the impact of movements such as sort of Me Too and Black Lives Matter on brands. I mean, what are the effects of these movements, the BLM and Me Too? What are they going to have on brands?
Well, I mean, I think, again, over recent years, we have seen, you know, whether it's BLM, whether it's Me Too, whether it's climate crisis, even, you know, brands' reaction to obviously the current health crisis, brands are having to make more of a stand on issues.
Right.
They can't just sort of hide behind these. You know, we had the rise of corporate social responsibility, which is now morphed into a wider sort of thing, I think, really, where consumers expect brands to have values that they stand behind, not to be silent. So I think, you know, BLM, Me Too, and so forth is interesting because it's made brands really think not just about how they react publicly. So, for example, you know, with the BLM thing, you know, it's not right to stay silent. As people said, not being racist isn't enough. You've got to be anti-racist.
Yes.
So brands need to say something. But equally, you know, I mean, I had a debate with a company where I'm a non-exec the other day, and it's a real balancing act because the instinct is to say we need to do something. But actually what I think the best brands are doing are also, you know, doing something but not jumping on the bandwagon. So,
we made the point... Just don't monetize it.
Well, absolutely don't monetize it, but also get your house in order first. So I think that was the discussion we had at that particular company. We said, well, hold on a minute. We don't have any directors that are black. So we can't sort of preach, we can listen, we can understand, and we can say we support, but actually what we've got to do is learn. And we've not only got to, you know, learn more generally, but we've got to learn about our own business. What are we doing right? What are we not doing right? What are we getting right? What are we not getting right? And how do we change? So how do we make sure that our business is genuinely a meritocracy, that there isn't these hidden unconscious biases, that, you know, and it's not just about color or gender, it's about everything. Are we genuinely doing all we can to make sure there is equality in our business and that we are doing the right thing? internally? And then how do we make sure that what we are projecting externally is supporting positive change, not, as I say, jumping on a bandwagon, but supporting genuine change, but also reflective of society out there. There was a great study by Lloyds Bank. I don't know if they've repeated it, but I saw it a couple of years ago around sort of, I guess, representation in advertising, and also, the hidden biases that mm-hmm. you know, agencies and brands weren't purposely doing, but through through how they recruited people and scripted things and the kind of agencies and the makeup within those agencies and so forth, they were just getting things wrong. And so, as I said, it's really important to kind of take a step back and not just take a stab, but go, hold on, let's properly look at everything we've done. And also get other people to look at what we've done mm-hmm. that are maybe not like us in whatever way that might mean, and just make sure we're doing the right thing.
Yeah, make sure we're not living in a glass house ourselves, you know, before we start lobbing stones, you
absolutely,
know.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So, I mean, you touched on the sort of climate crisis, and I think that companies have that. I mean, there are lots of companies that have kind of addressed that to a certain degree, and I think that's really become a great example of how, if a brand actually does follow through on its commitments to certain statements, that there will be a payoff in the long run. And the companies have to remember that, you know, just because you say you support BLM or you're behind the Me Too movement and things like that, that's not good enough. And you won't get short-term rewards from that. And especially in this sort of social world, you're probably going to end up with a large omelette on your face. But, you know, that there are the benefits are more long-term. And if you actually put the work in now for it, that it will pay off. Do you think that what's happened with the sort of climate crisis could be, you know, a lot of that could be parlayed into sort of what's happening with BLM and the Me Too movement?
I think, like I said, I think generally brands are having to act more responsible. And that's not only from a kind of customer attraction perspective,
right.
But also employees.
Yeah.
You know, more and more, we're in the war for talent. People say, I don't want to work there. They're not doing the right thing. And if you haven't got the right people, ultimately, you're going to slowly slide as a brand because you haven't got the best talent fueling that brand's success and driving the strategy and driving the marketing and everything
exactly.
else.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't think you can hide away from doing the right thing and being, you know, not only a good corporate citizen, but an excellent corporate citizen. And I think you equally, again, we talked about brands being emotive, you know, brand purpose and values are really important. I know some people are saying, oh, purpose is all rubbish, and some brands have gone over the top and trying to have this big altruistic, we're going to change the world, when in fact they're a soda maker or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And they're right. There is a balance between every brand suddenly going, you know, our main purpose in life is to make the world a better place. But somewhere within every brand, there has to be some purpose and there has to be good values, and certainly then there has to be good behavior that, you know, helps and benefits the planet that we all share. And don't get me wrong, for every consumer that is now seeking out an ethical brand and maybe paying extra for that ethical brand, so let's take Patagonia, a brand lots of people mm-hmm. talk about in terms of its sustainability and its attitudes towards the climate and the environment. For every consumer that's being attracted to that brand, going, that's a brand that I want to buy into because it shares my values. Of course, there are still two consumers lining up at Primark going, I don't really give a crap. I just want that T-shirt for £5, right? We have to be realistic about that, right? But nevertheless, overall, the understanding about climate change and particularly amongst younger people is growing. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, even if your consumers don't care, you have a responsibility to do something.
Yes.
And I think the best brands are doing something. And as I said, it's it's really important. We, you know, even a decade ago, we were talking about greenwash and so forth. But even now, the most enlightened companies are still not getting it right across the board. So they might be reducing the amount of plastic in their product. They might be trying to reduce their air miles. They might be trying to reduce the amount of palm oil they use that is maybe not 100% certified as being from sustainable sources and so on. They might be doing the right thing, but there's more change that needs to happen, because probably their employees are still, in terms of KPIs, OKRs, whatever they're using internally to give bonuses out, are probably still remunerated based on quarterly sales growth, based on market share.
They're incentivizing the wrong parts of the business.
Yeah. New product development is still under pressure to create new products. Some of those new products may not be as sustainable as some of the older products. So I think I even talked to you before about, you know, if you think about washing powder, we used to just buy one big cardboard box of washing powder and that was it. Now it's in a plastic box. Each little thing that we chuck in the washing is wrapped in a little micro plastic wrapped thing. And because it's convenient, apparently, but also they can charge a higher margin on it, quite frankly. But those products, you know, if you're Unilever or P&G and you're really serious about sustainability, you should be saying, well, let's not even sell those. Let's just go back to one cardboard box with some powder in. You have to
just put it in a bucket. Let people buy a bucket of it.
I think, you know, there's lots of positive changes happening. More fundamental change needs to happen. And as I said, more and more enlightened people will choose companies based on what they're doing, but we shouldn't pretend that there were lots of people that still don't give a crap and will just buy it if it's cheap and cheerful. But that does not mean that companies, if they want to succeed in the long term, can get away with not doing the right thing. Because as I said, shareholders, employees, and other stakeholders will also hold them to rights increasingly.
It's so easy to get called out, isn't it? I mean, that's the thing, is that, you know, you put a foot wrong and you will get called out these days, and it's very highly visible.
And I do think, Keith, that actually change follows money even more than legislation in many respects.
Right.
And I think if you're talking about sustainability, corporate behavior, and so forth, what you are seeing now is an unprecedented rise in ethical funds, and even in, you know, not labeled ethical funds, still saying, what is your impact on the planet? How are you treating employees? How are you treating the workforces in maybe other countries where you are sourcing products and so forth? And so the fact is, even if you are a business where your primary drivers amongst your consumers is value and convenience and so forth, and maybe those consumers are not the type of consumers that are putting things like the environment first and foremost in their purchase considerations, as I said, the money will still flow more and more to those businesses that are doing the right things, and businesses that are not will struggle in terms of accessing funds in the future. Because quite frankly, the affluent people that have got the money to put into the investment funds will demand that those funds are not going to businesses that are behaving badly.
Well, yes, and that's a great point. And it offers me a kind of nice segue as well, because, I mean, one of the things that I wanted to talk about was based on a conversation I had with an applied futurist recently, a guy called Tom Cheesewright, who I have been following somewhat, probably too closely, I'm not sure, I don't know, but I've been fascinated by what he's been writing about. And one of the things, he's just written a new book about future-proofing businesses, how to future-proof a business, not necessarily a brand, but I think a lot of it applies to it. And some of the behaviors that he's trying to get people into offer some interesting insights, these, given what we're all going through. One of them being that one of the virtues of a business these days has to be its agility, its own ability to be able to be faced with a crisis like a pandemic, and to be able to adapt very, very quickly to a new way of working without interrupting its own key core services and things like that. So, I mean, I think that there is, I'm going to turn that into a question. Would a company's agility Do you think that would be now factored into a brand's total equity these days? Its own ability to be able to switch into different modes if it needed to.
Yeah, I think great brands have always been customer centric, but I guess customers are maybe changing quicker than they used to be. So the ability mm-hmm. to listen to customers and adapt quickly, whether that's shifting products and services because of technology or environment or any other trend that happens to impact that business, I think will grow. I think more generally, I think flexibility and, you know, entrepreneurialism, you know, that was the big buzzword a few years ago, and it kind of died a little bit in some ways. But I think the entrepreneurialism within big companies is really important. I did a project for the Marketing Agencies Association a few years ago looking at what we call super entrepreneurs. You can see where we got the super name from. But and it was looking at big blue chip companies that were still acting entrepreneurially.
Right.
And I think that was really important because obviously what tends to have happened in the past is you have young, interesting, innovative challenger brands that come out with new innovations that are maybe closer to the consumer and have developed something the consumer wants that the big corporates haven't quite cottoned onto yet or brought to market. And of course, they get bought up by the big corporate.
Yep.
And so the big corporates with their shareholders, they sustain growth by essentially on an ongoing basis buying these more nimble, more interesting businesses that are, mm-hmm. that are maybe got stronger innovation.
Like Dollar Shave Club, Harry's, you know, all of those, aren't they? Very innovative businesses that were just there all automatically and suddenly became very, very attractive because the fact that they were built agile.
Exactly. So that's how it's tended to happen, is that the big corporates have bought these innovators. They've often then ruined them, but that's how it's worked. But I think increasingly, I think the big corporates have now realized that that can't be the way it is. They've also got to look within themselves and create an open culture that is more adaptable and more open to change. You know, firstly, we saw the rise of incubators. Mm-hmm. Lots of businesses going, well, let's have an incubator. You know, even agencies, let's have some people on the top floor that are the kind of, you know, they're the crazy wacky people we put up there, and they come up with some really crazy ideas.
Not the ideation team.
Well, you know, those kind of people, yeah. But, you know, it's like, you know, but I think what they've realized is actually this needs to apply throughout the whole business.
Yeah.
You can't just have a little team up there or a little group over there or whatever. If you want to thrive in the new world, you have to constantly adapt. And, you know, great brands, of course, have certain consistency. We did a program with CNN called the 100 Club. It was looking at brands that have survived 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
And partly they survived 100 years because, again, they had that emotional resonance. People trusted them. They knew what they were getting. And, of course, certain things, the benefit was it stays the same. You know, if you're getting your Bisto, you might want the Bisto taste the same as it did when you were a kid. It's probably a poor example, but anyway, I had Bisto in my head. I'm thinking
sure CNN folks were like, hey, what the hell's Bisto?
Yeah, exactly. Bisto who? But, you know, some things do have to stay the same, and that's a great thing about a brand, is there's a certain amount of consistency. But as I said, equally in today's society, where change has never been so fast, but equally it will never be as slow as it is today, adaptation, flexibility is important. And I think, you know, again, you see it with our retail industry.
Yeah.
You see so many great, well-loved brands going to pot because, quite frankly, you walk into the store and it's absolutely no different than it was in the 1980s. And that's not acceptable, really. You've got to understand what's happening and how people want to shop, when they want to shop, where they want to shop and everything in that example. And you've got to adapt. So I think being nimble is really important. And I think great brands of the future will be nimble. And that's predominantly based on culture again, which again, I guess almost goes back to the discussion we had a while ago now about pride, which is the connection between people and culture and internal brand and the connection between external perception and success and yes. delivering to customers what they want, when they want, how they want it, are so integrated now that you have to get the internal right if you want to get the external right.
That's, I mean, it's a great point, because I think one of the other points of the Tom Cheesewright book was about future-proofing, was the fact that there is an internal process that happens as well as the external process. So that people within a business have to be agile and have to be able to respond to agile thinkers within their own company. So it's not just them doing all the sort of the head work, that there are other people in the team that they have to force themselves basically to, or train themselves to listen to, and to be able to, you know, to understand that they too are thinking in an agile fashion. So I think that's very useful. And I mean, coming on to the fact that I think it's pretty much a given now that we're going to be sort of either slowly sliding into a recession, or it'll be a sort of a massive head first dive into it. But I mean, a recession always creates opportunities. People working in the world of business development in our field, you know, it's almost it almost has an opposite effect, where in a recession that people have to work harder and they look for more opportunities, and people working in business development are really sort of, you know, put to the test. And I think it's where people working in business development work best, when that kind of heat's placed on them. But obviously, some areas are going to benefit greater than others. With your wise sage head on, I mean, could you give us any predictions for industries that you think are going to be on an upwards trajectory over the next sort of 6, 12, 18, 24 months?
God, it's a good question, isn't it, really? I mean, I think...
I've got a lot of money riding on this, so...
Oh, damn. Well, I know. I wouldn't do that. I mean, what I will say is that I do think forecasting generally is really difficult. As I said, there's so many black swans, COVID-19 yep. being a classic example of it, but also every trend having a counter trend and a counter trend. So, you know, as I said before, you know, you had the rise of healthy eating, and then suddenly you had the counter lash with lots of really meaty, unhealthy products like meat liquor coming onto the market. And then suddenly it was all, you know, veganism and meat-free rose even quicker again. So it's like, how do you predict these things when there's a confluence of so many different competing factors, and it's hard to work out which one's going to win, you know, environmentalism versus health consciousness, age, you know, an aging population. So again, just talking about the meat-free stuff, there's so many different factors that interplay on it. So I won't sort of put my money on really specific industries. What I will say is that clearly brands, again, that use technology to enable businesses or consumers to live their lives more efficiently and effectively, and that are trustworthy, will prosper. Now, it could be anything from Farm Drop to Rightmove, as I've mentioned before. Those kind of brands will grow. There will clearly be a rise in sort of premiumized, eco-friendly, more value-based products. As we said, it won't be the whole market, but, you know, whether it's brands like Rapa Nui, which is a brand that I sort of, my current sort of love, which is a sustainable clothing brand from the Isle of Wight, more localized brands, quite frankly, as well. So it's not necessarily going to be about the big mass market brands. It will also be the rise of the local brands. But again, it's about that, you know, subscription as well. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be Freddy's Flowers, something like that. You know, I think those kind of brands that perform those kind of services for consumers will rise. What I think is clear, though, is as a general big macro trend, we are past peak stuff.
Right.
Now, what will happen with the experience economy will be interesting, because of social distancing. But in general speaking, even if we can't necessarily, you know, have as many experiences, so like immersive theatre was a big growth area before the crisis, that might be scuppered somewhat by social distancing. But generally, experiences in whatever form they might take, I think, are here to grow. And they will replace
materialism. I'm so glad you said that, yeah.
Yeah, so I think, you know, it could be as simple as, you know, online language courses.
Mm-hmm.
It could be, you know, online learning generally, people learning new things. The rise of crafts. We saw a big rise in people buying, you know, sewing equipment and other such things.
Sure.
I think people want to do things, experience things, learn things, push themselves, as opposed to, I guess in the past, buying things to go, oh, look, I've got this nice thing to show off or to whatever. And I think that's part of a wider cultural change where, you know.
It's the show and tell era.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, is probably still the big difference between certain geographic markets in a way. Certain countries are still in that show and tell era where they are economically developing and the rising affluent class want to say, look at my car, look at my house, look how big my TV is, and so forth. And I think we have moved past that. And again, sub-trends like environmentalism and so forth will be fueling this as well. But generally, as a society, I think we've gone past that to say, no, how do I feel better about myself? How do I live my values? How do I showcase who I am? And how do I do things, quite frankly, because I'm only on this planet once, that are going to bring me satisfaction? And it's probably not about the quality of some of the products I buy. It's about the experiences I have, the things I eat, the things I enjoy, and the things I learn, and so forth. So, I don't know if I've answered your question.
Yeah,
but that's for me is the bigger picture, if you like.
The interesting point about that is that related to that is that my particular sort of hobbies and interests have sort of led me into looking at the world of kind of virtual gaming and brands like Twitch and stuff becoming obviously more and more prominent. And I had an interview recently with a gentleman called Sean King, who's an investor in sort of green and new technologies and stuff like that. And he was basically outlining, gave me his insight into the kind of the opportunities there in the kind of e-gaming sector. And the chairman of the British Esports, I think his name's Mervyn King, I'm not sure, went on the record to literally lure advertisers to the industry because basically they don't have the same rules as the traditional sort of sports sectors and stuff. And so it's pretty much a wild west for brands out there at the moment. And, you know, given the fact that there's a sort of global ban on sort of mass attendance to events, I think that the rise of the kind of esports era, the esports companies is going to just continue, you know, sort of quite heavily. I mean, do you think that the esports era, the esports brands are kind of worth tracking now as a sort of a serious contender?
I think so. I mean, I think, again, you saw, I mean, look, even before this COVID-19 crisis, we clearly saw that esports is a massive growth area, particularly among the young. We've now seen, again, ironically, it's not just about watching from home. We see esports arenas now.
Yes.
So, you know, there is still a live element to people gathering and watching or playing in groups, so to speak. But you did see a massive rise in the esports. But of course, again, with COVID-19, that's accelerated. So, for example, with the close of Formula One, you know, most of the Formula One drivers were playing all kinds of virtual games on Twitch and so forth. There was also, of course, the you know, eFormula One races, which combined not only Formula One drivers but well-known sports stars. You know, Sergio Aguero from Manchester City was playing up against you know, Formula One drivers like George Russell and so.
Exactly. I can't fit into those F1 cars, but I can sure give one of them a hell of a run on a computer.
Yeah, and so I think, you know, those games, if you like, featuring those stars, they attracted huge audiences.
Massive.
You know, Lando Norris, who races for McLaren, has got a huge Twitch following as a result of his activities on e-games over the sort of lockdown. So I think that esports was growing. I think it will grow even faster, But again, you know, ultimately, once Formula One comes back, for example, there'll be a lot of people that were watching, the
Primark effect, they'll go back to it.
Which will move back to kind of going to back to the live Formula One on the TV and forgetting about the esports. But some people would have enjoyed it so much that they will definitely stick with it even when the live sport comes back. So, you know, but as I said, for younger people as well, it's a demographic thing as well. For younger people as well, there will be a group of people that will grow up, you know, from a young age watching these things, and they will stick with it. And, you know, therefore, as a longer-term trend, it'll be very interesting to see that balance between esports and real sports as the generations grow older and time goes on.
Fantastic. Well, I mean, you touched on it briefly there, but a lot of the kind of new wave of sort of marketing features the assistance of or the appearance of influencers like, you know, Joe Wicks, for example. And I've recently had an interview with a well-known PR agency that deals exclusively, well, not exclusively, but deals with the influencer market. And I was told basically that a lot of these influencers, the sort of the upper echelons of that market, regard themselves as kind of brands in their own right, you know, as people. I mean, do you think that at any point in the not too distant future that you're going to start seeing actual people appearing in your rankings as opposed to a company, so that somebody can attract that much attention as a brand?
Well, I think if you think about the definition I gave about brands right at the beginning, I mean, most people already are brands, whether it's certain, you know, well-known CEOs or indeed, you know, sort of online influencers. I think a lot of them are brands in their own right. I think they conjure up a perception and people love or hate them or somewhere in between, and a lot of them can monetize their reputation. So they are absolutely brands from that perspective. I think, you know, the influencer market more generally is, again, one of those relatively new markets which people are grappling with understanding and will ultimately settle down. I think the excitement about influencers initially is I think will die down a little bit.
Right.
I don't think they're the be-all and end-all. I think brands will understand that they're not the be-all and end-all, but they are important because, again, great brands are built on trust, authenticity, emotional engagement. How can you better create that than through people? Mm. People that are like people. Mm. So if I'm following someone and I feel that they are like me, or they're talking to me, and I trust them, and I believe them, and so forth, then clearly what they say and what they do is going to have a profound impact on my perception of the things that they are doing and saying, and the kind of brands that they are advocating or not advocating. So I think their importance is there. I just think, again, the market needs to calm down a little bit in terms of going, everything's about influencers and so forth. A, not everyone is on Instagram. Yes, there are huge numbers that are, but not everyone is on Instagram. Everyone that's on Instagram that's following people isn't necessarily doing exactly what that individual is telling them to do.
Right.
So we do just have to calm down a little bit. But I do think they are important because they are relatable. They are trustworthy and so forth. But that trust thing is the most important thing. And what we will see is, if you like, the shallow influencers, you know, the people that were spotted at the Black Lives Matters protest, you know, really sort of posing and getting their pictures done, where you're like, what are you doing?
Again,
you're not there for the right reasons. You're just there trying to get a picture to say that you're there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they were shown up. And I think that destroys that authenticity and that likability and that relatability and everything that I was talking about, which is where their potency lies.
Yes.
So I think you know, there will be, as in all markets, influencers that come through and are successful and build their credentials, and a lot that very quickly get found out and fall by the wayside. And I think we're just in that period of sorting out the wheat from the chaff at the moment. And I think also the definition of influencers might change. You know, again, just talking about Black Lives Matter, you know, I know you love racing, for example. You know, how much of an influencer is Lewis Hamilton on in general to young people? How much of a role model is he? And how much change can he make by introducing things like the commission that is introduced in Formula One to bring in more diversity into Formula One and racing and STEM more generally? Mm-hmm. He is way more of an influencer than certain just Formula One followers that might have happened to have developed a YouTube channel or an Instagram feed that are talking about Formula One.
Sure. So, well, you've got Bubba Watson as well over here in the States, you know, on the NASCAR circuit as well, which, you know, and I mean, he's obviously, you know, he's been in the news recently for, you know, fortunately for you know, for being a sort of a champion of the good. But, you know, I think, yes, that they can, this is their time now. And I think that if they don't seize these moments, then, you know, they're as sports people, I think they're kind of, or as ambassadors, I think they may be letting their public down slightly.
Yeah, I think so. But I think, again, what this crisis has done has made people that maybe didn't feel that they should be the voice of change, the Lewis Hamiltons of the world, some of the footballers, you know, the Bubba Watson that you mentioned, you've seen these people suddenly go, actually, I need to be an instigator of change. Yes. And so, you know, they're stepping into that influencer role in many different ways. And again, let's just take Lewis Hamilton as an example. He has a partnership with Tommy Hilfiger. He is helping to push Tommy Hilfiger and Mercedes-Benz, indeed, into being much more eco-friendly and sustainable. So his endorsement of those brands is much deeper than just, I have a large number of followers on Instagram and I'm going to tweet about those brands because I...
It's almost contingent on their behavior, isn't it? I mean, that's the incredible part of it.
Yeah, so, but I guess the point is, if you think about that influencer market, if some of these other people are stepping into the role of an influencer and indeed an ambassador and indeed as a trusted advisor of which brands to go with and which brands to avoid, they will surely in the longer term replace a large chunk of the people that are just professional Instagrammers.
Yes.
Who are just simply on social media, you know, showcasing a lifestyle and talking about brands.
Right.
You know, so I guess that's the point, that as the market evolves, I think that, you know, many of the professional, if you like, Instagrammers will actually be replaced by other people that are maybe experts in their field or just generally in their field and take those followers because they, again, they have the trust, authenticity, relatability, but also the expertise. And they have the credibility to have a voice more so than the paid for people. And of course, legislation changes as well. So the potency of an Instagrammer wearing something is somewhat diminished if they've got a big message next to it going, I'm being paid to wear this.
Yes, of course. Steve, this has been a fantastic tour of brands. I really appreciate you putting all this time aside to help us understand that the world that basically you're committed to and all your company's interests are. And so thank you very much for that. But when you're not analysing branding and stuff like that, I mean, how do you tend to switch off? I mean, do you have any kind of hobbies, interests that take your mind off things?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, obviously, I've talked about Formula One a lot, so that's one hobby that I'm very much looking forward to returning soon. I'm a long-suffering West Ham fan, which I think is more torture than enjoyment.
Emphasis on the suffering there, but
absolutely.
I'm an Arsenal fan, so I feel your pain, don't worry.
Yeah, well, not quite as much pain, but yeah, no, I mean, you're having a tough time too. So, look, there's all the usual things. I mean, travel, I know so many people talk about travel. I have to say, travel, as someone that is in the world lot of strategy and planning and data and so forth. I love to travel not only because it's a great thing to do, but I love to see other cultures and places and observe the behaviours and so forth. So obviously that's been somewhat curtailed at the moment.
Right.
But, you know, I think for me, as you've probably gathered, I do have a passion for what I do and brands and marketing. And
that's pretty obvious.
Yeah. One of the things I guess I spend some time doing, whether it's as a judge for the Marketing Academy or doing some visiting professorship, which sounds very grand at universities and so forth. But I do like to try and help the next generation. And I think as an industry, marketeers and branding people, we've still got work to do to elevate the profession and the how the profession is held.
Yes.
Amongst C-suite and the impact that we can have on wider business strategy and so forth. So I do that. But quite frankly, at this point in time, I'm quite enjoying not doing as much as I normally do, because for 25, 30 years, I've been running around like a lunatic, juggling so many different things. I'm a little bit quieter, and I'm purposely keeping it that way. And
fantastic.
It gives me time to reflect, and I am thinking of various studies and projects for the future. And I mean, look, as always, things come through the door, or touch wood, they do anyway. But I'm kind of hoping that I do have a little bit longer to step back, think, and think about some new opportunities, which you don't always get to do when you're juggling live products.
You see,
projects.
These are the roses that everybody told you to smell. You know?
Absolutely.
And so, you know, it's interesting. I'm glad. You know, it's nice to hear you've kind of done that. I think everybody is kind of starting to sort of notice that their behaviours have changed, and that means a lot to a lot of people. I think it's enriched a lot of people's sort of lives generally. But Steve, I know this show is going to generate a huge amount of interest people looking at sort of the work that you do. But if people want to get in touch with you, what's the easiest way for them to do that? Is that sort of via email, through the website, or what?
Yeah, I think via email's the probably the easiest thing to do. So it's just,
and we'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, I won't do the normal plug then.
Right.
just email me. I mean, obviously, in terms of your specific audience, I guess one of the things I haven't said is that in terms of research and kind of new beers and white papers and thought leaderships is you know, I've done quite a lot of that in terms of creating either proprietary tools for agencies, or indeed just, as I say, thought leadership projects. So we've done the Emotion 100 with Brand House. We did Talkonomics, which was looking at how advocacy works in the industry and amongst brands for the Exposure Group. Created Headspace for the Cubo Group, which was looking at, again, some of the kind of sort of more emotive ways of tracking and understanding brand as part of planning processes. So, you know, I love a really interesting, meaty kind of project which understands the fundamentals of brand success and sort of how to understand that going forward. So, so if there are any agencies out there looking at trying to get a bit of a steal on the competition through thought leaderships and want to do something bold and really look at something in terms of market dynamics and where the world is going and where brands are going, then those people I would particularly love to talk to.
And that would, oh, fantastic. Well, I was going to give you time to toot your own horn, but consider horn truly tooted. Well done. But so anyway, Steve, well, listen, that just leaves me to thank you so much for being a great guest. I'm so glad we finally managed to get this together. I know it was a long time coming, and I do appreciate you putting the time aside for it and sacrificing some of that beautiful sunshine I'm seeing out there. So thank you very much, and I hope we get a chance to do it again soon. But in the meantime, thank you very much, and all the best to you, Steve. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been my absolute pleasure. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to jump on my my bandwagon and rant about lots of different things.
So, well, if I'm driving your way again with my bandwagon, you're more than welcome to jump on it. So hopefully I'll see you again soon, Steve. Thank you very much.
Good stuff. Thank you very much.
And that's it. Steve is not only a hero for allowing so much of his time for our show, but I hope you'll all found this as interesting as I did. Thank you very much, Steve. I hope I get to talk to you again soon. As we begin to see the signs of a new dawn for us all in marketing and branding, we also need to emerge with a new state of mind. It's almost like the pandemic has had a cleansing effect on us. Well, some of us anyway. The future has been reinvented while we were all in lockdown, and for all of us working in and around marketing, it's never been more important to walk the talk with regards to branding and brand image. As usual, if you need to check out the contact information and references to the show, you can find them all in the notes on The Fuel's website at www.thefuelpodcast.com. In the meantime, thanks to our small but beautifully formed production team, co-producer Donna, IT wizard Matt Smith, musical gurus Peter Banks and Barney, but largely yourselves. Thanks for listening, and we'll meet again for more adventures in podcasting brought to you by The Fuel, the new business podcast in association with The Advertist, the new business development platform for the new business curious. And really, shouldn't that include you?